It's the Mike Tech Show, show number 457. This show is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Mike Smith. Thank you very much for downloading and subscribing to the show. Please visit the main website at miketechshow.com. You can email me questions and suggestions for future show topics. My email address is miketechshow@gmail.com. You can leave me a voicemail message. I got two voicemails that I'm going to lead the show off with. The phone number is 240-949-2450, and that's Mike Tech Show, all one word on Skype. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/Mike Tech Show. Send me a friend request on Facebook, facebook.com/Mike Tech Show. And don't forget to check out the wiki at mtswiki.com. Tonight, it's all about voicemail and email. Going to get caught up. So we're going to start right off the bat with this rant from Kate.
Hi, Mike. It's Katie Oles Katester from Kelowna in British Columbia up here in Canada. I wonder if you can answer a question for me or if some of your listeners know the answer to this question. Here's the question. When it comes to crapware like Conduit or Babylon, why does that stuff go undetected by or uncharacterized as malware by programs like Super Anti-Spyware and even Malwarebytes? I must have spent 20, 25 hours recently cleaning various implementations of Conduit out of customers' computers. And prior to that, Babylon. And every single time, Malwarebytes sat there happily scanning and didn't complain about any of this stuff. And the same was true of Super Anti-Spyware. So how in the world can these things not be considered malicious software? How can they not be detected by these anti-malware programs when you and I can detect them with our eyes? I don't get it. I mean, I get that maybe the first thing that's introduced is an opt-in. You know, somebody installs a toolbar or clicks on some kind of thing that says, yeah, I want Scrapbook Nook to be my homepage. But thereafter, the crap comes pouring in. Today I spent 2 hours cleaning. I believe there were 11 toolbars, a browser hijack, and all kinds of Conduit stuff out of a computer that was running Vista Home Basic with 2 gigabytes of RAM on a high-speed light connection. It's amazing that it only took me 2 hours. And it only took me 2 hours because I knew what I was looking for. And it's a good thing I did because none of these programs helped me find it. And by the way, if anybody else needs to know, Conduit now runs as a service. So not only do you need to find the things that are easy to find, like the toolbars and the programs that get installed, you have to go in and kill a process which will allow you to get to services.msc, which will allow you to find a couple of services that are conduit and stop them. Once you stop them, you can then change the startup type to disabled, and then you can get busy uninstalling stuff, either with Revo or Geek Uninstaller, or by brute force, or in today's case, both. Once that's done, then you can restart and go back and see if those services are gone. Now, today they were, but the time before that they weren't. I don't get it. I mean, this stuff just comes in on all different versions of Windows with all different versions of protection, and I'm making the dreaded air quotes here. And none of these guys, these programs that are supposed to get rid of malware, think it's malware. How is that possible? What am I missing? Thank you for letting me rant. I really appreciate it. And if anybody's got any ideas, I'd love to hear it.
Kate, I feel your pain. They're not considered malware, just like the Ask toolbar. And you know how much I hate the Ask toolbar. Yet, that is not considered malware, and it's not removed. I believe there's a market for a product to remove all browser helper objects and all toolbars and all things relating to that. But it's going to have to take a separate program, not a malware program. There are people that use it. This just happened recently. When I automatically see Ask on a client's machine, you know, I remove it. Do you know I actually have a client that said, I want that. I use it. I couldn't believe it. There are people that really do not believe this is malware. And how do you tell the difference? If someone really wants that, even though to us, we as techs, we do not accept this as legitimate software or legitimately helping us. So what's Malwarebytes supposed to do? They got to make a decision where something is infecting the computer and dumping bad things on the system and remove it versus, well, this is kind of questionable. So maybe there needs to be some advanced options on these malware programs, and maybe they need to extend what they're doing and have an option to remove all browser helper objects, all toolbars, all yada yada, everything that they don't consider malware, but we want it removed. Maybe that's what's needed as either a separate product or options within Super Anti-Spyware and Malwarebytes, because what's malware to you may not be malware to me. I completely agree with you, Kate, and I'm on your side. You are right. I believe they can detect it. They don't want to detect it. And maybe it's us as the users of the products to communicate with them and say, you know what? I want you to identify this. Here's the reason they might not be identifying it and give you the choice. Will the typical user know that this is something that they should decide on? Or would I instruct clients, anything that Malwarebytes finds is automatically bad, remove it? I don't even want them to think about that. So that's why this has to be an advanced option. It can't be something that just shows up. I spent hours, like you, cleaning a laptop for performance issues where there were tons of programs, coupon helpers, and that's a great example. To me, a coupon helper or a coupon program, to me, that's bad and I want to remove it. But there's people out there that want that. So to me, I don't want it because it's bringing in other junk and I want to remove it. I spent hours with Revo Uninstaller, which was the only thing that could remove this stuff, where I visually identified it and started you know, in the list of programs and features in Windows 7, and there was a ton of this junk, and the only way to rip it out was Revo Uninstaller, which is a tremendous program, which Kate mentioned, for removing programs and everything that's associated with that program, all the registry entries, all the directories. Even if there is an uninstall for that program, it normally does not uninstall all of the objects that are associated with that program. Kate, I agree with you. I understand. And there needs to be some more work with, I think, additional features in the malware software that we as techs can turn on, or as an individual can turn on and have it search for those items that they don't deem as malware, but yet things we want to remove, and then have it rip it out. Or a separate program. How about someone coming up with a anti-toolbar program, something like that, and you just run this and it'll just rip them all out. This is the next voicemail message. Give a listen.
Hey, Mike. My name is Robert. I'm from Charleston, South Carolina. I love the show. It is absolutely awesome how much work you put into it. And then Tech Vet Show as well with Carrie. You guys, I can't thank you guys enough for the hard work you do. I have a quick question for you. I'm trying to help a very, very small doctor's office. They have 4 employees maybe, but they have 2 offices in 2 different locations. And they use a server to keep everything centralized. They're still using XP. I'm about to upgrade them to Windows 7 and wanted to find a good server platform to be able to switch them to. They also need a web host, a HIPAA-compliant web host, to store their dictations that they do on some of their patients online so that they can disperse those to different insurances and stuff like that. I know you have some experience with a local doctor yourself. I'm wondering how you guys have set it up, and I'm trying to get some advice or maybe some tips on how to do this. I hope this makes sense. And again, thank you for your help. All right, Mike. Bye.
Great question. And we're going to begin with the first one, which is you're asking about recommendations for a server. I am going to answer your question with more questions because I don't have enough information. What do you want to centralize? Are there applications? Are there databases that need to be centralized? Are there software applications that have to run centrally or should be running centrally that everybody needs access? Or is it just shared files? Here's the reason. And then I even got more questions. You may not need a server. You may just need a NAS device. If it's just file sharing, why complicate your life? If they do need a server, you have to do some due diligence with those applications and determine, will they run with Windows Server 2012, which is what you would probably want if you're buying a new server, or do you got to go back to Windows Server 2008 R2 and run that? Because maybe those applications are older. So you have to make sure that those applications will run with whatever operating system you're going to choose for your server platform. But it should be one of those two. Now, what about email? Doesn't sound like they're hosting email, or they already would have had a server involved. If a client wants to host their email and they need SQL running, and we want to have Active Directory and a real domain controller, it might be cost effective to have Small Business Server 2011. So you have a lot of options on the server. I recommend Dell. Their entry level servers are very, very cost effective. You can put together a nice RAID 5 with a nice PERT controller, the operating system, and everything you need, and you can do that for around $3,000. That's a real nice option, and then you can go up from there as you start to add more redundancy, more power supplies. It depends how big you want to get. You need to answer those questions. What are you serving up? And then do you want this to be a real domain controller where you're going to marry all these computers into the domain and manage Active Directory? You may not need to go to that work. You might be able to be happy as a work group server if you're just sharing files and you just have SQL running. Answer those questions. Now, getting to the HIPAA, that's a great question. I don't have any recommendations off the top of my head for HIPAA-compliant hosting companies without doing the research. So I didn't have time for when I just got your voicemail recorded for the show. I am not working directly with any HIPAA-compliant hosting companies because even the doctor's office I'm working with is not doing anything with patient information on the web. But the way you described it, they absolutely have to be HIPAA-compliant. In the chat, I can't verify it, but someone recommended that Hostway.com is HIPAA-compliant. I'm not sure if Bluehost is. I would call tech support and see if they can give you any documentation and ask them straight out, are you HIPAA compliant? Show me on your website where you guarantee that and you say that. So you got to make sure any compliance that you're working with, you got to verify that with the email host, the web host, any kind of hosting services that's going to be dealing with their information. You must make sure that they certify that they are. And you're going to have to, again, do some due diligence by calling any company. Even if I was to recommend one, you got to double check and call them and just to make absolutely sure because it's too important for your client. First email for the show. This is from Chris. It's about future show topic. Love the show. Not long ago, you talked about testing hardware. If you have time, can you go into your process? Thanks. I have a fairly simple process for testing the hardware. And by no means do I say everybody should do this. This is what I do. If it's HP or Dell, I try to run the self-diagnostics that's in the BIOS. And what I will do is I will run the program from the BIOS to automatically start checking the hardware, the video, the memory, the hard drive, and at least see if it passes the diagnostics from the manufacturer. I always run Crystal Disk Info just to give me that quick look at the hard drive. I run MemTest 86 to make sure, is the memory okay? After those things, if we're still having hardware issues and problems, it's time for the user to call the manufacturer. I don't go any further. I don't do any board level repairs. I don't work on testing motherboards. There are other resources and other tools that you could gain to be able to do that kind of work if you like it. I don't like that. So I'll use whatever the manufacturer's diagnostics are. And I'll use, like I said, MemTest or Crystal Disk Info. And if it's memory, if it's obvious that it's memory, I'll swap it out. Yesterday, I just swapped out a hard drive for someone that the hard drive went bad. I'll swap that out, reinstall the operating system. Beyond that, I want it sent back to the manufacturer. I don't mess with it. I will not swap out motherboards. I won't do that. If it's more than 3 years old, someone has a motherboard problem, it's going to cost too much money for that. I'll counsel them into buying a new computer system. That's not the way all techs work, but it's the way I want to work. This is from Nolan. Hello, Mike. I had a question or two that I wanted to ask you. I wanted to know if you could pass on any tips or tricks that you have acquired over the years about keeping yourself looking professional when dealing with a customer or client that you just finished a repair job for that had a great deal of pornographic content or something that looked somewhat disturbing. I recently had a mother bring her son's laptop in a few weeks ago. It had a fairly common problem that seems to come up more than any other out there. The mother said, "My son's computer seems to be slow. So I go through my process of getting it up and running. Then the mother asks when I'm in the process of polishing up the job, getting ready to give it to the customer. The mother calls. She had asked, could you just upgrade the laptop to Windows 7 for me? I tell her, well, I'll need to charge you my flat rate to tune up and the flat rate fee for the Windows 7 upgrade. She agreed, so I start the process of upgrading. Now, this is going from 32-bit to 64-bit, so I had to grab all the old data pictures, videos, music, and documents. So as I go through the process of grabbing the old files, I notice her son has about 130 gigs plus of pornographic content and a folder just named Stuff. So I normally have a policy of I transfer the good, the bad, the ugly. The mother comes back and picks it up. I have her pay me, thinking all is good. 3 days pass, and the mother doesn't call. She walks into my store yelling that I'm a sicko, and why would I transfer her son's porn back onto his laptop? I just bursted out laughing that I was really in this situation. So my question is, how could I avoid stuff like this where I can't keep myself from laughing and keeping myself professional as possible? Sorry if this email was rather long, and I do appreciate your time for reading my email. Thank you. I don't understand why you were laughing. This is a serious issue. First off, I would never be laughing at anything that a client comes with me. Even if I think it's funny, I'm going to put on a face that is appropriate for working with my client. Now, dealing with pornographic, I ran into this situation with a 13-year-old where the system was slow. I'm working on the computer, and I called the mom over, and I said, come here. I said, you know, he's 13. Take a look. There you go. This is what's slowing it down. Oh, my God. You know, and I got the response, and then we had the talk, and that talk is, what can you do if you want to stream, you know, block this content? You know, we're open DNS and categories, and we have the discussion. It's going to happen. If it's a minor that I'm dealing with, a system from a minor, and that happens a lot. I can understand text being in this situation, and I run into this. I would do just what you did. I would transfer everything back. I never not transfer something. I do not censor the content, except in one case. If it's illegal, if I see something that is illegal, I will stop in my tracks and I will call the police. That is my policy. I will not call the parent. I won't call the user. If I see anything illegal, I will stop in my tracks and automatically call the police. I'm so glad, I knock wood here, that I've never had that happen. But that's my policy. Now, if it's a minor system that I'm working on, I will have a discussion with the parent, and I would do it in private in a situation where, if you have a store, I would have asked the mother to come down, or when she picked up the system, I said, come into my office, and you close the door and you show her what you transferred, and then you could say, look, this was on your son's computer. Let the mother make the content decision by deleting or saying, oh my God, get rid of that, and I'm going to have a talk with my son. And you would have been fine. I don't understand the laughing where you mentioned that twice. I guess that's me. I don't look at this as funny. I look at this as a very serious issue. I approach it very seriously. If it's an adult, and I run into this all the time, and they have porn on it, and it's not illegal, I'll transfer it. You know, it is what it is. That's what they want. I'll give it back to them, charge them whatever it is. But again, if it's a minor, I will talk to the parent or the responsible individual that is their guardian. I'll put it generically, and that's it. And then if it's illegal, that's it. I don't even have a discussion with them. I would turn that over to authorities. That's my recommendation. After my response to this email, I got into a little discussion in the chat room here about just a little bit on the pros and cons of me making an assessment and then reporting it to the police. That's just my moral code that I live by. I can't be a party to any criminal activity because I couldn't live with myself if I said nothing and then something happened to a child or to someone. I just couldn't do that. My makeup is, if I see something that looks criminal, I'm reporting it. I am so thankful I have only been in that situation once. I will share the story, and I'll keep it very generic. I was recommended to do forensics on a computer system for someone requesting it. This person suspected someone of doing something illegal, and that stuff could be on the computer, and it involved children. I was given the desktop, and I told the person, I said, why are you coming to me and not your attorney or not the authorities to do this? Well, we haven't reported this to the authorities. I said, stop. I said, I want you to know, when I begin my forensic analysis, if I see anything that is illegal, I am not calling you. I am reporting it to the authorities, and I am turning that system over. She said, let me converse with my attorney and decide. So the computer sat with me. I really didn't even want it, but I never touched it. She called me the next day and said, I'm coming by to pick up the computer. We don't want you to look at it. And I said, thank you. Okay. So she basically made her decision that if I did find something, she did not want that reported to the authorities. And so I don't know what's going on. I didn't know the details, but I never looked at the system, so I could never know whether anything was true or anything was not. But what I did, I stated my personal policy to that person. And that person then made the decision whether I should continue with the forensic analysis or not. I wanted to make sure that I was perfectly clear with the client, because here there was a possible situation. That's as close as I've came to any kind of a legal situation and working on a system. Weird Windows update fix from Jerry. I had a Windows 7 64-bit laptop that I couldn't get Windows update fixed. Turns out that I had to uninstall the Intel Matrix Storage Manager, Intel Rapid Storage for some. Boy, we've had discussions about this. I didn't believe it would work, but after reading the below page, I figured I would give it a shot. Laptop is updating just fine. So I want to thank you for that. I will have the link in the show notes, and it's something that I've actually ran into on an HP Pavilion laptop where I had to remove that very same driver because I couldn't get updates to work with Windows. Very weird, but great, and I will share it. That'll be in the show notes. This is from Chris. And this is in response to my gray screen of death. I've got a few responses to this. This is on a Mac. Hi, Mike. I'm listening to show 456 and heard you mention a Mac with a gray screen. I work for the local computer shop, and I have seen this problem. It was there all the time on the Mac whenever it was booted, as the CD drive wouldn't work with booting, and booting to USB failed too. I removed the hard drive to run on another computer. As PCs are the most common computers we get into the shop for repair, I had no Mac to slave it to, and I used a PC and booted to SpinRite. Thought it was worth a try. SpinRite found and fixed some issues with the drive. Boy, I would be afraid to run that on a Mac drive. After installing the drive, the Mac booted. Although it was sluggish to use, I suspect that the hard drive was on the way out. So clone the new drive, and the Mac runs like a new one. I'm not a Mac user and rarely get any in for repair, as they are so reliable, but maybe a gray screen is a symptom of a failing hard drive. On a PC, if a PC is failing, the hard drive can present itself as a boot failure, often fixed by check disk. So maybe a gray screen is the Mac equivalent system. It was for me in the Mac that I fixed, which was SpinRite, so maybe worth a try. Thank you, Chris. I appreciate that. Got another one, and this is from Andy in response to the gray screen of death, and he said, it's the memory. Even though everything points to everything else, he's seen this several times, replaced the memory, and that solved the problem. Here's another one. Run the disk utility and the repair permissions or repair disk function, and he believes it's the hard drive, and that's from Scott. Here's the thing. Apple just recently replaced the hard drive. They had recalled the hard drive from that particular iMac because it was subject to failures. So they brought it into the Apple store. They replaced it. Now, they had the gray screen of death before, and the gray screen of death came after. And it's not all the time. It's only occasionally when they reboot it, it comes up with this gray screen, and they have to try it a couple times. I have a friend that has a Mac repair store that I finally got a hold of and was talking to him today. And he said, Mike, just have them bring it into the shop. He said, it could be one of several things. He says, it might be the memory, might be the hard drive. There might be, it could be the system board. There's so many things that it could be. He says, until we get it in our hands and run all the tests, you know, we can't guess at that. So just have them bring it into me. This is from Gandalf. Mike, I listened to your podcast on the way to work. As an ex-consultant, I enjoy all the war stories. They are valuable lessons for those of us in the corporate world. You had a question about moving Exchange to the cloud. One tip I would offer is to not only pay attention to the DNS MX record, but also the SPF record. If you move Exchange without updating your SPF record, your mail might be denied delivery. If you don't have an SPF record, now is a great time to create one. Originally, SPF records were just DNS text records with a text string that started with SPF. Sometime in the last few years, the DNS RFC was updated, and now there is a true DNS record type called SPF. So you may want to convert any old SPF text records to the new SPF record type. The old SPF text records will work, but you could say the same about XP. Here are the two links I use to test SPF records and create SPF records. Great email. Thank you so much. And these two links for testing SPF and creating SPF, they're going to be in the show notes. Thank you. This is from Michael. He's got an odd question. Just love your podcast. I have been listening from the beginning and haven't missed a show yet. This may be a bit of an odd question, but I figured if anybody would know the answer, it would be you or your listeners. I'm a volunteer at local TV bingo. Answer the phone, run the cameras, and fix the equipment. And we have an old bingo machine that will print out one line of text for every four balls called onto a Panasonic dot matrix printer. The problem is that the printer is starting to fail, and we considered getting a laser printer to replace it, but that doesn't work as the bingo machine only sends one line of text every four balls, and then more than likely a carriage return. And even if it would work, it would probably spit out a page of paper for every four balls, and that's not an option. What I was wondering, if you know if there is some kind of interface that we could put between the parallel port of the bingo machine and a computer and somehow receive the printer's info into a text file. This way, we could save a few trees at the same time. Thanks again, Mike, and take care. Now, if I understand this, could you run a printer port capture on the computer? But I don't think so, because it sounds like we got to have it between the bing, like coming out of the bingo machine. In the chat, they just said, can't you just print to a file? Look at capturing the printer port output and try to print to a file instead of printing to a printer. So look into those options, and I think that might save it. I hope I'm reading that correctly. If I'm not, Michael, let me know. And if you got any tips, any utilities, any software, anything, and you understand this, and you can say, oh, Mike, you know, just here you go, print a file, EXE, and this is where it's located. We'll do it. Let me know so I could share that with Michael. A tip from Carrie Holzman. I have not tried this. He emailed me this tip on getting your start menu back in Windows 8, and you don't need a special utility. And this was from someone writing into Carrie, and he says, if you want to know how to bring back the start menu in Windows 8 without having to use Classic Shell, you can try this little trick. On the taskbar, right-click and select Toolbars. Select the new toolbar. Now, where it says folder with a flashing cursor, type this in. Percent, program data, percent, slash, Microsoft, slash, Windows, slash, start, space, menu. Now press select toolbar and you're done. So that's percent, program data, percent, slash, Microsoft, slash, Windows, slash, start, and then space, menu. I have not had a chance to try that on my laptop because I'd have to uninstall Start 8 and then give it a try. Someone try that out and let me know. Does that work? But here's the thing some of these other utilities do. If you invoke this toolbar, when you reboot your computer, does it boot right into the Metro interface or does it boot with the Start menu? See, when I boot up my Windows 8, I don't want Metro interface. I want my normal start button that I've come to know and love, and I do not want the new Microsoft menu. So I want my start button. This is from Josh. Great tips on SysTools. Hi, Mike. Great tip on the SysTools utilities. I have a remote business client that I have done some work for over the past few months who has some Outlook issues. His PST file is 40 gig in size, and thus scanpst.exe keeps bombing due to the 2 gig limitation. I was looking for a good tool to use, but just didn't want to entrust this customer's data to any tool found on the internet. So this is awesome to find. Question, how do I go about helping this client archive messages so we can compact his file and decrease the size? I am not well versed in Outlook myself. I know enough to be dangerous, as I used it many years ago in the corporate world, but not since, and really have not had to do much with it since. It seems to me that archiving is something that the client needs to do himself. Oh, absolutely, but you kind of need to teach him, as only he knows what messages to keep and what to archive. Matter of personal preference and daily usage. Am I thinking right here? Or not? And how can I best serve this client in that regard to help them do this? Thanks for your thoughts. Love the show. Well, do exactly as you described to me. You need to show him how to create another PST file, another data file, how to properly name it and give it a good description, and then teach him how to start collecting messages and moving it there. And only he can decide, is it by topic? Is it by date? Does he want to archive by year, by month, by from who sent it? There's lots of ways to begin that archiving process. So what I would like you to do is have him think about that and then show him how to do it. What you may need to do is practice yourself with Outlook on how to use the wizard and create a macro and create a rule, really. They call them rules. You could create a rule that says when this topic's found or if this date of a message is found, move it to XYZ folder and then run it and let it go against his folders with a PST of that magnitude. Before he even begins archiving, I would want you to put in place something like Shadow Protect for desktop, which will get a system image before he there would ever invoke on this. And anybody with such a size of a PST as a client, and I have one, and I've talked about it, and this one, he's gotten above 19 gigs for his PST file, and that's just way too big, and he does occasionally have problems, and we've had to do a restore. I made him purchase the software and we do a system image. And you know what? We've had to do a restore. And you know what? We do that system image every single night. Or you could do at least a full system image on the weekend and then incrementals every night so you know you absolutely have a backup of that mammoth, that massive PST file, because you do not want him to have problems. First, system backup, then advise him on how to archive, but let him make the decision of what he's archiving. That is it for the content for tonight. I do have some music and a couple things. Thank you so much. As we enter the month of May here, I want to thank everybody for continuing to use my Amazon link, and that's amazon.micnation.net. I want to thank you for bookmarking it and sharing it with family, friends, relatives, everybody. It's so important, and it really helps support the show. Your price is the same, but a small percentage comes back to the Mike Tech Show and really helps. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. And continue to use amazon.micnation.net. I have a special song that was requested by a listener, and this is the cover song from an REM song that I actually really like. And this is the Coors Unplugged covering this song. Give a listen.
When your day is long and the night is yours alone, when you think you've had enough of this life, well, hang on. Everything is wrong. Now it's time to sing along. When your day is not whole, hold on. Hold on. If you feel like letting go, hold on. If you're sure you've had to of this life, hang on. In this life, the days and nights are long. If you're sure you've had too much of this life to hang on.
That was the Coors Live Unplugged from a few years ago, and that is for Kevin, and the song is Everybody Hurts, and that's the cover of REM's great song. So I hope you enjoyed that. I'll have a link to where you can purchase that from Amazon. I want to thank everybody for downloading and staying subscribed. I really appreciate it. Spread the word for the show. And that's it. I'll see you all next week. Same time, same channel. Thank you.
You've been listening to The Mike Tech Show, a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. Please visit techpodcast.com.